Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and we've got a really great show today. It's going to be really interesting, something a little different. But before we get there, I have a couple of really great shout-outs that I want to make. First, I want to remind everyone that Brian Park is doing some really great outlines for some of the ACRAC episodes. So take a look at the show notes for episodes that you're listening to. If you see a link that says Outline by Brian Park, click on it because those outlines are really useful, especially if you're using these episodes for studying. The other thing that I want to recommend is a really great podcast that's out there called The Nocturnists. Now, I'm not involved in this at all, and I'm certainly not getting any support or financial support or anything from them, but it is really neat. I listened to a few of them, and I think it's fantastic, especially for anyone involved in healthcare. If you've ever been through a difficult time, if you've struggled with your life in healthcare, if you've struggled with a difficult patient interaction, if you've had just a lot of stress or frustration with the patient medical record, anything like that, I think you really connect with this. This is a bunch of physicians who get together in San Francisco and they do a live show where they share their experiences. They obviously change the patient details so that it's not violating HIPAA, but they talk about their experiences in a way that's really neat and I think can be really supportive and even healing for people in medicine who go through similar things. So I'd highly recommend checking it out. You can search for it on iTunes. It's called The Nocturnists. All right, so let's get on with our very exciting show for today. So I am excited to have with me today Jonathan Curley, who is a resident, an anesthesia resident, at Texas A&M down in Temple, Texas. And Jonathan reached out to me, and we're going to talk more about why, but just has such an interesting story and a really fascinating take on life and on his approach to residency, stemming in no small part from his time in the military. And so I want to share with everyone and give Jonathan a chance to share with everyone some of the kind of life lessons that he's learned that he has applied to his life and to his approach to anesthesia training that I think can really be useful for everyone. So Jonathan, thanks for reaching out and welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
All right. So let's jump in. Let me just ask you to maybe briefly introduce yourself. Tell people who you are and, you know, what makes you someone who would reach out and want to share what you know.
Sure. I guess a little bit of an intro. I'm, I guess, a non-traditional resident and medical student before. I went to college, undergraduate, typically after high school, straight to undergraduate. Where I studied and was not quite sure exactly what I wanted to do, but for many reasons, after graduating college, I joined the military. I did the U.S. Air Force with a contract specifically to become a pararescue man, or PJ is a short version of that. So I'll probably say PJ a lot of times when I talk about what I did.
And PJ is short for pararescue man, is that right?
It's actually a coding thing. So it was created back in Vietnam, and PJ was part of like a coding for the term. So PJ doesn't actually stand for anything other than the coding.
Okay.
But
what is pararescue?
So a pararescue is it's under the special operations umbrella on the U.S. military. And really, by different special operations groups all have different niches that they fill. Where PJs, the niche they fill is we're trained and able to retrieve personnel as well as equipment from pretty much anywhere on the map. If you threw a dart on the map, we'd be able to, we're trained and equipped to retrieve personnel or equipment from that location and really to get through any obstacle that might be in the way to retrieve that that personnel equipment. Examples of obstacles could be open oceans, cliff faces, avalanches, anything, including up to enemy forces. It was created in Vietnam to respond to a lot of helicopters that got shot down in that time frame. That happens less often now, and so as a result, we end up getting tasked to do a variety of different things. different rescue operations in Afghanistan, Iraq, and even civilian rescue operations, especially in Alaska and other places like that.
Great. So, you know, I will say that the other motivation I had when I got your initial email to want to pursue this with you is because as a new program director, I talk to a lot of other program directors who've been doing this for a long time when I go to various conferences. And as I told you, program directors will often comment on the fact that they find that people with a military background tend to make very good residents. Now, that is an interesting observation. I think it's probably true. And I'm interested to hear from you some of why you think that might be true and what, you know, as I said, the lessons that you learned. But I'm curious, you know, what made you decide, hey, I'm going to reach out to Wolpaw and see if he wants to do a podcast episode with me?
Sure. I think in general, anybody with a previous life experience is going to be able to bring that to a residency and make them a better resident. I do think military do we learn a lot of lessons in the military that are difficult lessons under difficult circumstances. I feel that a lot of veterans have a lot to offer as far as life experiences. But as a group, we tend to not share those lessons. And I think there's a lot of reasons why we don't, that I could go on and on about of why people, veterans don't share their experiences. But that would take a while. But I've kind of come to the realization lately through listening to different podcasts that I listen to and reading different books that I think it is wise to maybe share a little bit more of this because there's a lot of very stressful and difficult things and we tend not to share it. And I think it could benefit others. As far as my motivation, particularly for this, it all kind of stemmed from I listen to the podcast regularly, and I went for a run out on a weekend. And as I came back, I was listening to the podcast like I normally do. I came back in and I saw a CBS special, and on that CBS special, they were talking about something called the Travis Manion Foundation, and the Travis Manion Foundation. So I learned on the special is a foundation that pairs up veterans with particular youth that lack role models in life. And it allows the veterans to tell stories of people that had passed away or in the service and how those stories affected them as people and providing mentorship, particularly to youth. And this organization is run by three widows that lost their husbands in the global war on terrorism. The first one is Heather Kelly. She's the daughter-in-law of the Chief of Staff, John Kelly, who lost her husband, Robert Kelly, on November 9th, 2010, in Helmand Province, Afghanistan, by Rotem Bomb while doing a dismounted or walking patrol. The next one was Ryan Manion, who is wife of Travis Manion, who was killed on April 29th, 2007, in the Al Anbar Province in Iraq by sniper fire. While he was attempting to provide aid to wounded teammates during an ambush. And finally, Amy Looney, who's the wife of Bren Looney, who was killed in action when his helicopter crashed in combat operations on Afghanistan, September 21st, 2010. And the part that really struck me in the story was that Bren Looney was known to live by this mantra, and he would constantly say it over and over again, per reports of the people that knew him well, be strong, be accountable, and never complain. So two parts of that, that struck me. One is this whole organization exists to share the stories of people that were killed in action and to motivate other people to be better and more productive. And two is that that Brendan used this mantra, and he would say it daily and regularly, and it seemed to be saying that that this helped him achieve greater things. And the part that was, again, interesting to me is that in my time in the military, I saw that it's very common for people to use slogans like this, use sayings like this in order to enhance their performance. And it's something that I personally started doing. I did it as a medical student as well as, but in my CA 1 year, I came up with one that was actually kind of similar. And the one I came up with was work hard, team first, do the right thing. And where this comes up for me is every so often when you're at work, a thought might come into your head that, you know, maybe I don't need to do this extra pre-op to get ready for tomorrow, or maybe I don't need to give a break to somebody right now. I could just kind of relax, or you know, those little thought that did bring you maybe down the not ideal path. And what I end up doing is I say this to myself, work hard, team first, do the right thing. And when I do that, it becomes clear that I should do that extra pre-op. I should give this break. And it's no longer a question. It's no longer a temptation to not do the right thing.
And is that, now, let me just ask you, Jonathan, so did you find the same thing? It sounds like Brendan, the gentleman you talked about, had his mantra, be strong, be accountable, never complain, and use that in the military. Did you also find in your time in the service that having those catchphrases, those mantras, would help you with difficult situations there?
Definitely. So in my time in the service, I was going through training, we had to say, every time we went into the training facility, every time we left, we would recite this thing: "It's my duty as a pararescueman to save life and aid the injured. I'll be prepared at all time to perform assigned duties quickly and efficiently. These things we do that others may live." We would say it and then end it with "Hooyah." And every single time, we'd say it all the time, and it was almost a nuisance at the time, going in and out of the schoolhouse, and we would be, if we messed up on something, we would have to pay with physical activity. And so I didn't really appreciate it at the time, but once you start doing the job and you start seeing the amount of sacrifice it takes to do the job that we had to do, and it's difficult to explain to people that maybe haven't done this, but imagine going through terrible terrain with hundreds of pounds of gear on, carrying other people that are injured with, they've got hundreds of pounds of gear on while you're sleep deprived. And it can be very grueling. It's not as, I mean, maybe glorious as you see on movie, how one might see in the movies. And those times that slang really becomes, real and, it has more meaning.
So practicing it may have at times been frustrating when you were just in training, but when you were in the field, when it was the real stuff happening, you found it to actually really help.
I did. And, what I found to be more helpful actually than that, saying, that saying became real to me later on, and it's got an emotional response in me now. But we would say things like "Hooyah," "Get some." And it's funny because I think you could make a comedy movie almost on that, almost having the stereotypical military guy saying "Get some" and "Hooyah." But things like that really have a lot of power with us where we're in. And I think to best illustrate that example would be to cite Lieutenant Michael Murphy, who was popularized by the book Lone Survivor and the movie Lone Survivor, who, if anybody that doesn't know his story, but he was with a SEAL team that was ambushed and compromised out in the middle of nowhere where they couldn't get contact with their headquarters. And he ended up moving out from a covered position to a clear, open, wide open position where he must have known that he would pass away by doing this, just to make a phone call to reach headquarters to give his team the best chance of survival. After taking multiple rounds, and he continued to make the phone call and ended it with a thank you. And to me, I find these kinds of actions to be very interesting and something to self-reflect on, because I don't think anybody can say I would have done that, but to know that the outcome is going to be death and still to do the right thing requires a lot of gusto and some motivation. I don't know if he said beforehand "get some" or "hoo-yah" or any of those stereotypical things, but we would often in the military use slogans like that in order to motivate us to do something that's very difficult that we didn't want to do.
Yeah. And all right, well, that's fascinating. So let me ask you this, and this may seem almost like an obvious question, at least to you, but I think it's interesting to think about. Residency is hard. Now, it may not be as hard as the military, but let's just say for people who haven't been in the military, you know, residency is tough and you're going through it. And I think what happens sometimes is people think, and they're not doing it consciously, but I think they do kind of get to a point where they think, look, I'm working so hard when I have to, that when it comes to a choice of do I give back more to the team, or do I take some more for myself? Let's just use the example of, you know, maybe the end of the day, you could go home or you could give another break, like you said. Well, I think some people think, look, I need some time for me. I've got to go home. You know, I'm going to put myself first rather than the team first. That's a hard thing to struggle with. So why, in that situation or any other, you know, what would you tell people? What motivates you when you choose? And we could go all the way to the extreme of the example you just gave of Michael Murphy, who you know, gave up his life for his team. But what is it on a much more basic level that people might face on a more daily basis? What is it that makes someone say, or why even would someone say, I'm going to put the team first?
What would motivate someone to put the team first? I think, with my experiences, the closeness that we had as a team is really what was that driving motivation. To apply that to residency, I don't think the same level of closeness is for everybody in their residency program, depending on the size, I'm sure. But I would say that the reason putting the team first is important is because I myself am not special. And if I go home early without helping out the team, somebody else has to pick up that slack. And so just having respect for your fellow teammates, and I think that is the main motivation for me of why putting team first is so important.
Do you find that you may actually get some personal satisfaction from putting the team first, in the sense that it may actually, contrary to maybe first glance, making that sacrifice and putting the team first may actually improve your well-being because you then, you know, you did it, you kind of feel good about yourself and the contribution you've made?
I like having my conscience clean. That's for sure, to be able to go home and know that I did the right thing. But at the same time, during residency, and I think throughout a career, you're building connections, you're building a reputation all the time. And I'd prefer to have a reputation as someone who does work hard and does the right thing and is dependable. And I'm sure that would pay dividends in the future. I don't think the reason for it. I really think it's just general respect for the people that you work with. And if you don't pick up slack, someone else will have to. So.
Great. Well, thank you, Jonathan. So let me ask you, you mentioned to me that you were intrigued by a podcast on MCRID, another fantastic podcast that involved Mike Loria, who's a fellow veteran. And do you want to talk a little about that and share with people what you kind of found interesting about what Mike talked about?
Yeah. So Mike Loria was a friend of mine, and I went through training together with him. He recently went to med school a little bit after I did. And University of Chicago. He's going to be doing emergency medicine shortly. And he's been on multiple podcasts on MCRIT with Scott Weingard. And he did a recent podcast where he talked about a paper that he wrote in the Annals of Emergency Medicine in 2017 called Psychological Skills to Improve Emergency Care and Providers' Performance Under Stress. And basically, Mike is really interested in human performance and especially response to stressful situations. I'm a little bit more interested in leadership and how people respond to difficult decisions. But what he talked about there was very applicable to kind of what I said and to Brendan's mantra that he had. And he said, in order to do well under stress, he has this mnemonic, it's beat the stress fool, which he says in a Mr. T voice from the 80s.
Now, are you going to show us what that means? What's the Mr.
T? I don't think I'll do as well as he did. Beat the stress, fool.
All right. Awesome.
Is the mnemonic. And that stands for breathe, talk, see, and focus. And the two parts that I would like to expand on slightly are the talk part and a little bit about the focus, because I think it is it's helpful. So for the talk, he describes it as a positive self-talk and describes this kind of cognitive reframing or as changing your mindset. And that you could use, there's a bunch of different kinds of self-talk. There's instructional, motivational, mood-related, and self-affirmative talk. Instructional example might be MS Maids. I use that pretty often during not just setup, but during the case, just kind of troubleshoot things. And then motivational.
Now, let me just ask you, John, to share with people, because maybe everyone doesn't know what MS Maids is. What is that?
Yes. Machine suction, monitors, airway, IV, drugs, and special equipment is how I do it. And just a way to set up the room, as well as I use it sometimes to kind of sweep through the room and make sure there's nothing missing or something gone awry.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's great. So I think another common one is SOAP IM. So that's a one we commonly teach, but same exact, right? So suction, oxygen, airway, pharmacy, IV, and monitors. So similar things to make sure you're not forgetting anything. And then in terms of sweeping, the other one that you're reminding me of is that I was taught actually by my program director, my second week ever of CA 1 year, is ABC, ABC. So airway, breathing, circulation, obviously. And then the second time around is anesthesia. Make sure you have some on. B for body position. Make sure the arms haven't fallen off. The head isn't, you know, sitting on top of some little IV piece. And then C for Celsius, meaning check the temperature. So those kind of things, I agree, can be really useful to get you making sure you're not forgetting anything.
Yes, and so Mike said that this he mentions that this sort of talk of positive self-talk to get yourself in a positive mindset for a stressful activity can be very, very powerful. And that's kind of the same thing I was saying about with Brennan's quote of how using an internal monologue of a reminder of be strong, be accountable, never complain can change your mindset and help you do the right thing even when the right thing is hard. And actually, I think is a common misconception about people in the special operations community, perhaps that they're this superhuman or different than maybe the average person, and that's not the case. I need this every day I use my saying almost every day to help me do the right thing. It doesn't come natural. There's still temptations to maybe slack off here or there, and I feel like it helps you stay on the right track. And so it was just interesting that Laurie brought this up, and it was a big part of his paper of using this self-talk to not only perform well, but also motivate you to do the hard things.
And do you have some tips, Jonathan? Let's say, or does Mike have tips? I mean, let's say someone says, oh, great, I want to try this. They come up with something you use, as you said, be strong, be accountable, never complain. Somebody may come up with something else. But, should they use it? Should they practice it when they're not in a stressful situation? Wait until they are? Should they do it a certain number of times a day? Can it be long? Should it be short? What are some guidelines of how to come up with and use these things?
In his paper, and Mike's really good at this, if anybody's interested in looking at some of the stuff that he's come out with, he's really good at going over the research and the science behind a lot of the things he writes about. Two of the things that stood out to me in reading his paper is keeping them short and saying them multiple times per day, not using it just when you need it, but just multiple times a day, just repeating it to yourself, which, again, stood out to me when I heard his podcast. That's exactly what Brenda was doing. He was it was short, be strong, very short, be accountable, and never complain, very, very short, and just saying it over and over again. And all of his friends that were interviewed, at least on there, were saying that he would always say this. It was a constant thing that he was constantly re-saying.
Yeah, so, that's great. Mm-hmm. And, there's some interesting research, actually, that also suggests this can be useful for families. So families that have a slogan can actually get through difficult times better than families that don't. And I find that so interesting. But my wife and I have started with our kids. Actually, we started a long time ago when they were very young, saying things like, Wolpaws are problem solvers, not complainers, right? So that's always how we address the whining that is an inevitable part of being a child, obviously. But, having that slogan is supposedly, very useful. And obviously, as you and Mike have mentioned, also at work, too.
He also mentioned that it was interesting that and I agree with this. It's interesting that this was never taught to people in the military. We just kind of adapted to it as a way of survival. And as I already mentioned with the example of Michael Murphy using it to do things that would otherwise be very difficult to do, to accomplish very difficult tasks. And it's interesting that so many people in the military kind of just picked this up along the way. And Mike in his podcast mentions that, and as well as a paper, that these are techniques that are taught to CEOs at very high levels, and these are techniques that are taught to people in NASA. And it's odd because to me it seems very obvious using these kinds of self-talk and motivational techniques. But apparently it's not completely obvious to everybody, since it's being taught to athletes, NASA, CEOs, all sorts of people.
Absolutely. Now, you mentioned you wanted to focus on two things. So that was the talk. What about the focus part?
So the focus part, I think, is interesting. And this is a little bit of a side note, but he used the word focus while he's in a stressful situation to kind of get himself back on the task. And I had something similar, and it's just weird. It's strange to me to read Mike Loria's paper and say I came to those same conclusions with our similar backgrounds. The one that I use and I've been using all year is prioritize and execute, which is actually comes from a book by Jocko Willink and Leif Babin, Extreme Ownership.
Okay.
They wrote a book, and that's one of the things that they talk about, prioritize and execute. And I find that this to be very useful. I use it a lot actually in my intern year when you would come into ICU, for example, and there's a bunch of patients to be seen, and maybe my co-interns are really anxious because there's too many to be seen in a short amount of time. And I'm like, relax, we'll just prioritize and we'll execute. We'll see the most sick patients, we'll see them first, we'll take care of whatever needs to get done, and then we'll move on to less severe things. And I think it's just a way to just, in a stressful situation where things are going awry, just stop, prioritize what needs to be done, and then execute those things first.
Yep. Kind of bring yourself back when you find you're freaking out a little bit or you've lost focus.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. Now, you know, there's one thing I want to ask you about that I believe on that same episode Mike and Scott talked about, which is square breathing as a way to kind of help focus, help yourself de-stress in the moment. Which I thought was really interesting. I had not heard about, but I actually now have started doing more when I'm frustrated with my kids, actually, so that I can calm down more than at work, but certainly at work in stressful situations too. But I, you know, square breathing as a way to very carefully breathe. And I think that they mentioned it as a technique used commonly in the military. And the idea that they described, and you tell me if this is something you do as well, but is to, you know, take a breath in over 3 seconds, hold it for 3 seconds, or maybe it's 4 seconds, hold it for 4 seconds, breathe out for 4 seconds, wait for 4 seconds, breathe in again. So you can imagine that as a square wave of breathing. Is that something you are familiar with, and do you find that useful?
It is something I'm aware of and that I used a lot in the military, particularly in the in our training in the pool. So when we went through our training, our selection at least, a lot of it was in the pool. And there was a lot of underwater activities to stress us as trainees going through the selection process. And we were taught to breathe certain ways to kind of decrease our heart rate under those environments. And some of those were used later on in the during operation. Again, it's not something that was taught inherently to us. It's something that we would naturally use. And interestingly, when I listened to Mike's podcast, I kind of didn't really pay attention to that part as much because it's not in my personality to really kind of get into these breathing techniques, and I'm more a little analytical and straightforward. But on a recent day in the OR, I had a patient that was not doing well at all and had to get a central line placed during the middle of the procedure, and it was in less than ideal conditions, and it was a stressful situation. And I found myself, as I was prepping all the equipment for the central line, I took a deep breath in, held it, and I a little bit like pressure as exhaling and a slow breathe. And then I remembered right after I did it, I was like, that's exactly what Mike was talking about in the podcast. And so I naturally did it in that circumstance, and I know I've done it before. And so that is something that I've used in the past, and I think Mike gets into a little bit of, I believe he does in his article, of the physiology behind it and of how it helps under stressful situations.
Yeah, absolutely. So people can check that out more. Great. So you've shared already some really interesting stuff that you've applied. Are there other lessons that you have learned along the way that you think are applicable to being a good resident or successful resident or however you want to define it?
Yeah, there are. And so I'm going to share a bit of a story that's a very personal story to me. And I kind of preface with, although I reached out to talk about these topics, in particular being a good resident and some of the lessons I've learned to help me be a good resident, I'm in no means saying that I am a really great resident. And I really feel that a lot of the people that I've talked about so far and that I will talk about in the podcast – would have been much better resonance than I ever could be. But the just having them as role models and heroes, personal heroes, I think helps me want to get better. And I think in general, people that listen to podcasts, like people might be tuning into here, they listen because they want to get better. And I think wanting to get better is definitely the first step. And I'm gonna share a couple of their stories. One of the reasons this is such a more personal story for me is because when I was deployed in Afghanistan, before deployment, I worked with a small group of guys, and there were three of us that worked together very closely. And the reason we worked closely together because we were going to work in that group of three more than anybody else. It was one officer, another enlisted guy, and myself. And while I was deployed, another team that was in a different part of Afghanistan, their officer got ill with a skin infection that was bad enough that he had to go back home. And so because of that, they were lacking an officer, and we had extra on our team. So the officer that was on my team with myself and another guy, he was going to get assigned to that unit. And originally the plan was that all three of us were going to go. It was going to be myself. His name is Joel Gentz. And another one, which I won't name because I think he's still in. But the last minute, they changed their mind, and it was just Joel that went, and I stayed at the base that I was at. About 3 weeks later, I was in, and I was going through my gear and my bag and just making sure everything was squared away and set. And we got word that a helicopter was shot down and that a PJ team was on it. So we flew out, and we were above, and we were circling above, and saw the helicopter crash below, and there was chatter on the Taliban had their radios, and we can hear their radios because they don't have the technology of encryption, all that. And they were saying that they had eyes on us, and they were about to shoot us down, our helicopter. And as a result, we got called away, and another team went to go do the recovery, which was one of the hardest things I've ever had to do, is not land there, knowing I didn't know who was on the helicopter at that point, but I knew that I knew them. We didn't know who it was. And so we went back home, and another team actually did the rescue operation there. So it's a very, that was because I was there and the connection that I had with that flight, that's a very personal story. And I really hold their lives and kind of what they stood for as things to strive for.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. Maybe do you want to tell me a little about each of them and what kind of how they inspire you?
Sure. So first one was Joel that I'll mention. And Joel was, I remember him as he always wanted to be an astronaut. He went to Purdue, graduated in 2007 with aeronautical engineering, and he was kind of top of the class, really high GPA, just did a great job in pretty much everything he'd done. And that's how I remember him. I remember him as an overachiever, someone who could have done anything in life. And in fact, another story about him, he was an avid runner. He ran the Boston Marathon and was in the top 4% for that. And it just kind of shows what kind of person he was. He was just an overachiever. Mm-hmm. And so when I think back on Joel and the fact that he can't continue to overachieve in life, I am just not okay with things like doing the bare minimum with getting an average ITE score or which is an exam that we take every single year in anesthesia, or just hitting the bare minimum requirements with things. Because I know Joel wouldn't do that, and Joel's not able to continue to overachieve. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the big lessons I get from Joel, and I hope every day to bring a little bit of that with me. The next one was Ben White, and Ben White was an interesting guy. He was from Tennessee. A real kind of a country kind of guy who didn't swim at all, which is funny because he went to pararescue training, which is a very difficult course to get through. My class started with 80 to 90 people. I'm not remembering exactly how many it was. And we ended up graduating with six.
Wow.
And all the people that fell out were all in the pool. So we'd go to the pool and they would just find ways to make us miserable in the pool with breath hold and different activities. And people would quit throughout the pool sessions. So showing up to INDOC, that was a selection course, so that's what we called it, not knowing how to swim at all, and making it through the other end is really a lesson in perseverance. And when I think of Ben White, I think of perseverance. And I think if Ben White can make it through NDOC, that selection course, not knowing how to swim, I can make it through my next call. I can make it through a residency. I can make it through a fellowship. Those things are not going to be an issue.
So, yeah, that's really a story, as you say, of perseverance, right, of someone being able to accomplish your goal if you stick to it, no matter how kind of hard or how high the barriers.
Yes, and it's very applicable. There's actually a med student that I know of now, and he's trying to decide whether he wants to do anesthesia or not because he's not sure if he wants to do neurosurgery because he's maybe not sure if he'd match. And I haven't been able to talk to him yet, but I want to talk to him and tell him the story again. And I think he should do anesthesia because I'm biased, but
of course,
you could do anything if you just persevere. And I think that's a story that Ben White, reminds me of.
Great.
The last story on that, there's three people that I had a personal connection with, even though there was multiple people on that flight. It's Michael Flores. And I get kind of emotional sometimes when I talk about, you know, his story. So I'm just going to read it. But I love a little excerpt here that I'm going to read. But Michael Flores, when I think of Michael Flores, I think of a family man, and I think of priorities. He was survived by an extended family that loved him dearly, including a wife, son, and daughter. I personally feel this is the greatest tragedy of war, that sons and daughters lose their parents, spouses lose their loved ones, and parents lose the best thing that ever happened to them. Michael will never get to tuck his son in bed again, or his daughter, or help his daughter with his homework. And that is a tragedy. I take the story to heart, and I'm very conscious of how I spend my time as a result. For instance, if a case is canceled and I have an extra 2 hours suddenly, I could use that to eat a snack or watch ESPN. But if I do that, that's less time at home to help maybe my daughter study or hold my brand new baby that I've recently had a brand new baby. So I can't take these simple things for granted because so many parents were robbed of these opportunities. And that might not be applicable to everybody, that little excerpt that I read there, but everybody's got something at home that they value, and it's something at home that's important to them. So on a day-to-day basis, wasting time, and I know you did a podcast on time management, that's one I actually have not heard, but I would reference people maybe to that.
Yeah.
But wasting time in the day might take away from things that are very important later on. And the lesson from Michael for me is that our time is very valuable and to not take it for granted.
So, yeah, you know, it's so interesting. And as we talked about before, there are times when it sounds like you may choose to stay at work to help a teammate, a co-resident or something like that. But when you have free time, you're really going to maximize your studying. You're going to maximize whatever you can so that when you get home, you can really spend that time with your kids.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, I think that's, you know, a really great lesson. I agree with you. I think time management is so key. It's very hard to do all the things that we're asked to do as medical providers. Certainly as residents, it's even harder because you're working a ton of hours. You've got other things that are put on you by the ACGME, a quality improvement project, research, et cetera. It doesn't get a lot easier as an attending, but you're probably working less hours. But in general, it's hard. And so if you can structure things so that you can be efficient, it allows you, I think, to actually do better from an overall well-being standpoint because you do get to have a little bit more of that time you need with your loved ones, family, et cetera. So when we talk about kind of maintaining a good attitude, a positive outlook, you mentioned that some stories that really speak to that. Are there other things that you keep in mind that help you keep up a positive outlook even when things get tough?
Yes, I'd like to reference two people. The first one is Pat Tillman, which I think has a lot of valuable lessons looking at Pat Tillman's life. But and also would like to plug his scholarship for anybody that's listening and that likes running. He's got a run that is April 27th, 2019, which helps fund a scholarship foundation that is a really inspiring scholarship foundation and does a lot of good work. If anybody's interested in looking at the Pat Tillman Foundation, I'd recommend doing so because they have some really inspiring stories on there of people that have won that award and that scholarship.
Now tell
us,
who was Pat Tillman?
He was an American football player who played for the Arizona Cardinals. He was drafted in the seventh round of the 1998 draft And he wasn't even projected to make the team, which is, again, a story of perseverance of how, and overcoming things, because he ended up becoming a record holder in tackles and an all-star football player. And then in 2002, when he was facing an opportunity to get a big contract because he was an all-star, exceeded all expectations of being a seventh-round pick, instead of continuing on as a football player, he ended up joining the U.S. Army, enlisted as and became a Ranger. Then on April 22nd, 2004, in Afghanistan, his unit was ambushed. And during the fight, while he was providing coverage and helping fellow soldiers, he was ended, was killed by fratricide, which is killed by our own forces, which is a tragedy. But the thing that really strikes me about Pat Tillman, I think there's so many lessons to be learned about, learned from him, was the fact that he stood for something, he stood for an ideal, and he was completely dedicated to it. And he stood for something that's meaningful. I think as an anesthesia resident, it's easy to kind of focus on the end of everything, of a better job, a better paycheck, a better life, and to not focus on the today and the right now, and to focus on something meaningful of today. And for me, what's meaningful with my work is, and one of the reasons that I went into anesthesia, is that as an anesthesia provider, we were able to be there, and I put air quotations around be there, for patients under such a wide variety of circumstances. Because for that person that's receiving anesthesia, this is a pivotal event in their life. I really think that we're privileged to be able to be there for them during that time. And so that's the thing that I like to focus on, that's meaningful. Meaningful, and it's kind of on the same lines of what you say of at the end of your podcast, of what you do is important and valued. Mm-hmm. And what we do is important and valued, and it's appreciated by our patients.
Absolutely.
I think a good example of these things are like during a C-section, just to be there and for somebody during this time, and to reassure them that it's going to be okay. That's one event that's very general, but I really appreciate that time. It's just a monumentous event in their life, and you're able to assist them through it and keep them calm. Another example is recently a pre-op lady that had a hemorrhagic stroke, and her mom was in the room, and I got her to sign the consents for us because I'm very sorry about what happened and just show compassion. And I could tell that really made a big difference at that moment for that person, that there was somebody there to share this experience and to show empathy to somebody. And I think Pat Tillman's story shows that it's important to have a value for today to stand for, not to kind of look at the future, which is easy to do during residency.
You know, I love that you say that. I think it's easy to do in life, right? It's very easy to be so focused, and especially in medicine, especially because we're taught this from the beginning, but to be so focused on the eventual goal that you miss the journey to get there. And there's a lot of wonderful things along the way, even in training, right? Even though residency is hard, as you point out, there are very real interactions with patients, with colleagues, with people that you meet that can really be wonderful and can help you grow as a person. Those things are easy to miss if you're so focused on getting through every day to get to your goal that you don't pay attention to what's all around you.
Yes. The other story that I'd love to tell is someone of Mark Forrester, who was I met when I was deployed in Afghanistan. He was assigned to a Green Beret unit, or a Special Forces unit, and he was a combat controller, which means he directed air attacks to enemy forces or whatever they needed. And I met him because we were doing actually a body recovery, which is another tragedy of a Special Forces soldier that got swept away by a river as the Taliban controlled the flow of the water, and saw them crossing and raised it for the last man. And their body was not recovered, so we went in to assist in that recovery. During that recovery, we were in the middle of nowhere. There was a small village right outside by the river that was completely run by the Taliban that we had not controlled at all. And through our efforts of recovery, the Taliban constantly was trying to send in different fighters to either sweep us up and capture us or kill us during our recovery attempts. And Mark Forrester was pretty pivotal in preventing these things. And I remember we would take shifts kind of doing the search, and I was up on a bluff, a high position, overlooking the watch area. And I remember one time Mark ran over to me and grabbed me and said, "Hey, come on, I'm going to show you something really cool." And he directed an air attack that was a bit away, but not too far away. And they had a bunch of jets and helicopters came in. A lot of explosions, and it was one of the cooler things that I've ever seen. And he was just so excited about what he was doing. And then another look time, and just kind of illustrate the joy that he brought to his work, is he was directing different fighter jets above as we were doing the recovery. And again, I'm up on this high bluff, and he was talking to a Navy and a Marine fighter jet. And he kind of spurred them on to have a competition with each other of who could fly lower to the ground. To our position. And I don't remember who won, but I remember that both of those jets were so close. I don't know how, but I think I saw the guy like wave as he went by, because I could see his silhouette, which I don't know how I could have seen because he was moving so fast. But it was a really cool thing to see.
Wow.
And Mark was hooping and hollering and just loving his job. And that's the memory I get of Mark, that he really loved his job, because unfortunately on September 29th, 2010, he was in a fierce fight with the same Special Forces team. And they were moving through different terrain in a village. And one of his teammates was shot and killed. And Mark moved back to his location to try to retrieve him and ended up getting shot and was fatally killed. Mm. And it's a really tragedy, because he was a really, really great guy. And but when I remember him, I remember how much he just loved his job. And the lesson I get from Mark is don't let other people rob you of joy at work. I think anesthesia is I feel very fortunate. I get to interact with a lot of different people, get to use technology. There's so many great things about anesthesia, and there's always difficult people at work. But I really try to not let anybody who might be difficult take away the joy of my job, because it's a fun job and I'm fortunate to do it.
And are the things that help you when you're facing a difficult colleague, surgeon, attending, whatever it may be, that help you do that? I may be just thinking about the lessons you learned from Mark.
Well, in general, interacting with other people, there's always difficult people that are difficult to interact with at work. And I definitely think that general military experience of being able to say yes, sir, and just nod my head goes a long way. And especially some particularly difficult surgeons, perhaps it works very well for me. That's something that's I have a lot of experience doing, because it's something you learn during the military, and mm-hmm. it's hard to kind of suggest that to others. But I think in general, just interacting with different people at work, that the best thing to do is to treat other people with respect, and that goes a really long way. A story to kind of illustrate this would be someone named John Brown. I'd like to tell a story a little bit. But John Brown was a guy that I knew, but he played football, and he was a basketball player in high school, big athlete, and ended up going to John Brown University, coincidentally. And he went on a swimming scholarship, and he was really interested in anesthesia. And he wanted to be a nurse anesthetist, and that was his goal. But going through college, he saw some recruiting videos and of the different special operations community, and ended up becoming a PJ instead. And which is a story not too different than my own. While he was a PJ, he was very accomplished. So another thing that people don't know about in the special operations community is, people often think a SEAL is a SEAL, or as an example, because everybody knows about the SEALs. But there's SEALs, and then there's special units in the SEALs, and there's just special teams on those teams, and the rabbit hole gets darker as you move down. But John Brown was on a specialized team of PJs that do the most sensitive missions, the things that you never hear about, and was not on the same level as myself. And I met him when I was deployed. And this, although there was this big difference between us, I was brand new, never deployed before, never really done anything. And he was very experienced on this very specialized team. When he met me, he shook my hand and he treated me like I was completely the same as him. And I remember he brought us over to the compound that they were at, which is on these bases. They're these special units that do things that no one ever hears about. They have their own area that nobody else can get on there. There's a guard there. It's all wired off inside a base. And nobody else can go in there. But he would bring us in, and they're with me. It's fine. We'd go in there and hang out. And so I just remember how nice and respectful he was, even though he didn't need to be. I try to remember that. And I find that a lot of times people at work might not be as respectful, or I don't want to say a lot of people, but it's easy at work to fall into not being as respectful to people that don't have as much experience, or maybe people that have different experience than you. Mm-hmm. Not as much experience in my case would be like some of the interns or the med students, or different experience would be other consultants. And instead of kind of talking down to those people who are not, even amongst your colleagues, seeing that they have value and that they're important, it goes a long way in showing people respect. Ways that I'm able to employ this at work is just saying hello to people when I walk by, and just in general, listening to people and giving feedback that what they're doing is important, and the general mission of taking care of the patient is fulfilled with their presence and what they're doing. And I think that goes a long way.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. Jonathan, I just want to really thank you. You've really taken some time. You've shared some incredibly personal stories. I think they're the kind of things that can really help people, especially people who are at this point not going to go back and serve in the military and have those experiences. But to hear you talk about them so eloquently and so meaningfully, I think are things people can really take into their own lives and practice. And I think it makes a big difference. So I want to thank you, as well as, of course, thank you for your service to our country and all the hard work you're doing now in residency, helping your teammates and your patients. So thanks. Thanks for coming on the show. Thanks for sharing everything. And thanks for all you do.
It was a pleasure. Thank you very much.
All right. Wow, that was fantastic. I'm so glad that Jonathan reached out. I think a lot of those things he shared, the courage he had to share them, are really inspiring. And I hope you agree. Please feel free to reach out, comment on the website if you have things you'd like to share with everyone, maybe your own stories if you've been in the service. And of course, if you want to reach out to me, acrac@acrac.com, I'm happy to pass any comments along to Jonathan personally. Special thanks, as always, to Brian Park for his work on the outlines for the episodes, and to everyone who has signed up for Patreon to become a patron of the show. Your support means a lot. If you haven't yet, you still can. Go to patreon.com. That's patreon.com/ACCRAC, patreon.com/ACRAC, where you can become a patron of the show and help support the making of the show. We would, of course, really appreciate it. Also, if you haven't recently, even if you have, but it's been a while, consider going to iTunes and finding the podcast there. Leave a comment and a rating. That really helps other people find the show when they're looking for an anesthesia-related podcast. You can, of course, check out all the episodes that we've ever done at acrac.com, as well as join the mailing list and leave comments on any episode that you would like. All right, that's it for today. Huge thank you to Jonathan Curley for the ACRAC podcast and Dr. Jonathan Curley. I'm Jed Wolpaw. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.